Hang in there. It is. Smiley Kaufman for 61. Wow.
I'm Smiley Kaufman, and this is The Smiley Show.
Welcome back to another episode of The Smiley Show. I'm Charlie Hume. The man I'm looking at right now, Smiley Kaufman, is wearing a t-shirt emblazoned with the peacock, the NBC Sports, are we saying it Versant or Versant? Can you help me with that
Versant.
One?
To get the show?
Versant. Okay, yes. Cool. Well, the reason why he's wearing this shirt is we're going to lead the show. We got a lot to dig into, a lot of off-season stuff. We're going to get real clerical here. I'm going to do my best Charlie Day, It's Always Sunny, Pepe Silvio yarn board for Smiley today as we look at all the different changes and eligibility categories heading into 2026. But the place we got to start, Smiley, recording this on Thursday, November 13th. Some big news dropped earlier today that we are both thrilled about. This show, The Smiley Show, wherever you're watching this or listening to it, is going to be on Golf Channel on Wednesdays at 9 a.m. Eastern in 2026. And we're pumped, man. I cannot wait for this.
Yeah, I'm really excited. And thanks to all those at Golf Channel and Versant for making this happen. These discussions started earlier in the year about the possibility of bringing the show to Golf Channel. So this, for us, you know, we've been doing this, 3 years now? Is that about right?
May 23 is when this all started.
Yeah, May of 23. So to get on the TV in 3 years, we've been, of course, with a great sponsor with Sports Grid over the last, 2 years now. So it's been fun to watch this show grow, especially with new fans along the way. And I think we're just going to continue to speak to a little larger audience as we go, which for us, we're going to continue to upgrade the show as much as we can. And so I think you'll see a little different twist to the show in 2026 when it comes to just the overall visibility and the visual stuff that you might see if you typically watch on YouTube. So to see it on Golf Channel, it's something that we're going to be super proud of. And we've always been proud of like the stuff that we've always put out. But I think you'll see just a little bit of a twist on the show that I think a lot of people will notice the difference.
Yeah, if I can have permission to get a little sappy here, a little corny here. I mean, it is kind of wild thinking of where we started, where, you know, it was just the two of us. Taylor Zarzer got the phone call from him at PGA Tour Radio at the time over at SiriusXM and getting this thing going. And we were a tight-knit unit. We brought on Jackson Brown. We've had a lot of really cool contributors who have made this thing look and sound really cool on YouTube, on socials. Brian Stansfield plays a huge role in this. To go to Sports Grid, to see an up in quality there as well, and now to arrive at Golf Channel. I know for you, Smiley, you broadcast on Golf Channel all the time. You won a golf tournament that was televised on Golf Channel, the Shriners. But for me, as a kid who grew up, you know, watching Big Break in my living room with my brother and my dad, and to think that that's where we're going to be next year, it's a real pinch me moment. And I just can't wait to, as you said, we're doing a lot of really cool things right now in terms of development, looking forward to some new visuals, some new sounds, some new, you know, sights that are going to make this thing elevated. But it's just going to be the same old fun conversations we're having, yeah, just being two golf sickos. And that's going to be the best part of it, I think.
You're right. And it's some segments we're really excited about too for next year to unveil. So
I'm just going to give it to me, visual tease. Okay.
Yeah, that's right. That's good.
I'm pointing in a direction. Okay. Just stay tuned for that one.
A lot to be excited about as far as just, you know, from a scheduling standpoint for people that are used to our calendar and how you find us and how you watch us, you're still going to get two episodes a week. For Golf Channel, we're going to be having one episode that airs. What time is it on Wednesday?
9 a.m. Eastern on Wednesday morning.
9 a.m. Eastern. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that will just be, you know, if you're somebody who's an avid watcher of our show, it's going to be a condensed version of our two shows that week. Maybe more of one than another. It just kind of depends on either the guest for that week, but we're going to try to kind of put together what we feel would be our best version of those two shows on the Golf Channel show. So if you're somebody who already consumes all of our stuff, it won't be an extra show. It'll be one of which that we will already have done potentially either on that Monday or that Wednesday with our typical drop dates when we get back in the new calendar season. So it's exciting. We're excited.
I don't know what instructions to give everyone, you know, like, and subscribe. We can't really do that. Maybe like take pictures of you watching it, write handwritten letters to Versant and to Nielsen telling us how much you love the Wednesday 9 a.m. slot. Maybe that's a good place to start, but, it's as you've mentioned, it should be a best of. If you're already watching Golf Channel, it'd be cool to kind of see us on there, but nothing changing in terms of the current ways you consume this show, whether you watch on YouTube, whether you listen on a podcast platform, whether you consume us little bite-sized form on social media, you can still find us in all those places. And of course on Sports Grid, both on Sports Grid's television channel and on Sports Grid's Sirius XM channel. We're staying in all those places, just adding one in 2026.
Yep, it's a great opportunity for us and just in general for the programming of Golf Channel, I think.
For the program.
Yeah, and just how they're presenting more ways to consume golf content on Golf Channel. There's other shows joining us as well. Chad Mum in his show heading there as well, going to be the time slot after us. So it's cool that Golf Channel is kind of leaning into different golf content with different podcasts that give different perspectives. So we're excited to be included in that bunch.
I look forward to begging them for merch so I can get on your t-shirt level. So exciting
it's
stuff.
Comfy. It's very comfy.
It looks it. Excited to give you all more updates on that as we kind of near the launch of that show in January 2026. But as promised today, Smiley, we have a lot to get into. There are a number of category changes, things that are happening in terms of where you could have gotten a tour card in terms of where you are on a list in 2025 and how different that is for 26 and what that means for your entry into tournaments. The first place I'm going to start is turning the microphone over to you so you can kind of set the table on this. And then I will do my best to fill in with the maybe 19 to 37 tabs I have open over here as we go.
Well, this is locker room talk. This is what all the players are talking about at the breakfast table. This is what they're talking about in practice rounds. Is the PGA Tour and the way it's structured right now the most fair with how they distribute points to its members? And I think before this past season, where Maverick McNealy, one of the smartest guys on the PGA Tour, brought up some incredible points using a great case study for a player who finished high in signature, or I should say more so the 11th to 20th place finishes versus a player who finished maybe inside the top five of a full field event, and comparing the amount of points and just arguing, it's like, is it easier or harder to do what this person did? Which I think finishing top five in a full field event, beating 144 players versus 70 guys and finishing 11 to 20, you can definitely make the case that the top five is more impressive, although the strength of field isn't as strong. So
if I could just read that was that 2025, that specific change that Maverick McNealy suggested there, the changes made were for the majors and the Players Championship. There was a slight increase to second place points and a slight decrease to points for positions 11 and beyond. And then for signature events, there was a slight decrease to points for positions 7 and beyond. Want to jump in there with that? Please continue.
Yes. And so heading into 2026, I think it was interesting for a lot of people that follow this, especially players, agents, looking at this list to see at the end of the year, is this the most fair system that the PGA Tour has to offer for its members? And I think you have to start by, first off, thank you for the PGA Tour for sending us some incredible intel and information to be able to kind of compare and contrast to see who got it more of their percentage of points in signature events versus full field events. And of course, you can also mention that a player like a Tommy Fleetwood, he didn't really play any other events, other signature events. So of course he's going to earn all of it, all but most of his points in signature events. But I think when you, the game that I'm trying to play here today is, can we find holes in the system? Can we look at the Tour Championship for guys that barely qualified versus players who didn't, and look and see, okay, did this player with playing hardly any signature events or very little versus a player that got into all of the signature events, how much better of a season did this player have than the player who didn't get into the signature events? And I guess I'll start the conversation with this, Charlie, which is something that I kind of already mentioned, which is, do you believe as a fan of watching PGA Tour, knowing that full field events are weaker than signature events, although they have, let's say, 144, maybe 156 players at times playing in them, do you, which event do you take as far as maybe not winning, because winning a full field event, it's currently you're getting 500 FedEx Cup points versus a signature with 700. Let's start there, actually, with winning. Do you believe that there's a 200 point difference in beating 69 guys versus beating 143 guys?
It's such an interesting question, because you're looking at something that is an objective result. You know, there's an objective number of players in the field, and there's an objectively one person who shoots the lowest score and hoists the trophy. And then you're saying, now there's this thing we made up, FedEx Cup points. Can you just ballpark how much harder it was to do that? And I think the inclination that I would come into this discussion with, or and maybe many feel the same way, is you would say, okay, well, even though there are less players, you're guaranteeing me in many ways that the best players in the world, or at least the best players on this tour, are going to be playing in this event. So I should think that it's harder to win a signature event than a full field event. You have some data on that, correct?
Well, the data that I have, I spoke to somebody inside the PGA Tour that asked the question in their stats department, this exact question. And the answer that was given back to him was that it's more difficult by the data, whatever this data is, that it's more difficult to win a full field event with 144 guys versus 70.
Interesting. Very interesting.
So I found that interesting in the fact that, let's go back to the points and how much is given for first place in a signature versus a first place for full field. 700 versus 500. We're talking 200 point difference in a win. And when we talk about how, you know, every time it always seems to come down to one putt to qualify for something at the end of the year, it really starts to add up, especially for players that aren't in these signature events.
I think that is an interesting lens into just where we are in the professional golf landscape at large right now, right? And that there are, you know, we just came off an episode where we talked about LIV Golf making responses to that golf landscape and hoping to achieve, you know, whether that's major entry, be it OWGR, or just better preparing those players for majors. They're making changes, right? We talked about a tour, the DP World Tour, which I'm sure we'll discuss at further length as we get into this episode and talk about some of the things happening with them, you know, of where they're best positioned now and in the future for the health of their tour, and who they're best taking money from and passing off players to, and things like that. And as it relates to this tour, the PGA Tour, you know, you kind of wonder, in some ways you lament the fact that we are where we are with you know, this huge gap, this chasm of 200 points. They're really worth 200 more points to win these events, where it's not necessarily the spirit of where the PGA Tour came from. You know, these fuller field events, anyone has a chance at winning. But it is sort of, it's a little bit of the sign of the times. Like, this is a vehicle that was created, this signature event model. There was an evolution of the WGC, and it was largely meant to put guaranteed money in guys' pockets, not dissimilar to what we see over on the LIV Tour, you know. And I know some of them have cuts, some of them don't, but the goal here is like, hey, we have these guys, we'd like for them to stay around on our tour, and we need to find a way to get them money in a lot of different ways. And this is one that connects with actually playing a golf tournament.
I think the argument that players would make, Charlie, if you asked them this question about which one is more difficult to win, I think most would say, well, it's going to be more difficult to win a signature event. And so I would then ask, okay, well, what about finishing in the top 10? Which one do you think is easier to do? And I would argue that it's more difficult to finish top 10 in a full field event than a signature event. So with the logic of, okay, it might be more difficult to win a signature event, but I think it's maybe a little bit easier to finish between 5th and 15th in a signature event versus 5th and 15th. And it would just, maybe with how much better you feel like you played at a full field event, to finish 5th through 15th and get as little of points compared to a signature event with beating, you know, got the percentage of players that you're beating in that, is it's crazy the difference. And you're working really hard for your points on full field events.
Well, and I think what that connects to, and we're having a layer of different discussions all kind of come back to the same place, which is like, you know, how open of a shop is this really on the PGA Tour? Like, what are they really doing to make it so that other guys are getting chances to kind of come into the system and play their way into things? And so at the end of this, the sort of the tour card cutoff was 125, now going to 100. The discussion is around guys that are getting their tour cards, not being able to get starts and being behind the eight ball if they're trying to kind of make enough points to retain their tour card for the next season. But what we're talking about right now is signature events where it's, you know, the top 50 guys from the previous year. And then you add in, you know, the next 10, the swing five and guys like that, is that they're now getting jump starts on staying in those events. And then, you know, it's a lot easier to stay a part of that group than it is to play your way out of it, because you just have the opportunity to get these sort of free points. Free points is not exactly right, but you know what I'm saying, right? Like, just that it's if you and that's why some of the smoothing that was done last year with Maverick Menealy was essential, because to your point, with the less people in the field, and you go snag some sort of, you know, T7 or, you know, T12 and you're getting way more points, it you can kind of skate by and stay in that group next year, which isn't necessarily fair.
Totally. And I pulled some examples, and if you want to maybe pull up the chart that we have prepared for everybody to kind of follow along.
Screen share time.
If you're listening, it's a good time to maybe head to our YouTube page. Make sure, of course, you like and subscribe while you're there.
Oh, and look at that plug.
Yeah, how about that? Yeah, getting pretty good at this whole podcasting thing. And we have a chart here, and what this chart represents is the amount of points a player earned in that first column will be the full field events. So if you see red, that is obviously a low amount of points that they're earning. Yellow is kind of in that medium range. Green is in the higher range of where they earn their points. So from top to bottom, based off of, I think this was heading into the Tour Championship, was before I got this data.
This is through the Tour Championship.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. This is why you see that massive number in the right hand column for Tommy Fleetwood.
There you go. So as we flip through this, I think the exercise that I wanted to do the most in this was try to find a player who played maybe a little bit better than somebody who made the Tour Championship that had maybe a little bit less of a season, but because they were playing in signature events, were granted just that advantage of earning a little bit more points for playing the exact same or maybe a little worse. So the two players that I pulled, if you scroll down a little bit, you'll go down to Kurt Kitayama, who finished 35th, it appears in the,
I'll highlight him right here.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So Kurt Kitayama, if you see all the way over there to the right, you'll see that he got 0 points in signature events. And because that he had a win late in the season, I believe it was a 3M. So he really was having an okay season to that point. Wins a signature event late, wasn't quite rewarded with getting into a signature event like a player that, let's say, won at the beginning of the year. Then he would have had an opportunity to, of course, play in these. So he's maybe a tough argument to make because, you know, it's not exactly like he was just lighting up top tens throughout the whole year. But why don't we compare him to, let's say, Sung J.M. or actually Hideki Matsuyama might be a better example. So if you scroll just slightly up, you'll see Hideki Matsuyama at 29. Here. So he made the Tour Championship. If you see on that very right side, it's a green for the signature events with 958 points. And then you'll see in the middle column, by the way, for those of you who are looking at it, the middle column is how many points that she earned at the Players of the Majors. So you see that Hideki didn't have a good Players or major season, only earning 135 points. But then you see the full field events at 215 points in that yellow category. So I wanted to then go to the PGA Tour website, Charlie, to then see, okay, how can we compare these results between these two players throughout the year to see, okay, did Kitayama deserve to be in the top 30? Did Hideki deserve to not be in the top 30? So understanding that Kurt Kitayama, I think, only played in one major championship or either one player, seeing that he only had 28 points at in that category. Kurt Kitayama was four. He had four top tens on the year, with one win being at the 3M. And Hideki Matsuyama, one top 10 and one win, and also finished 29th in the FedEx Cup. So Kitayama with three more top tens than Hideki, both with one win, and one player making the Tour Championship and the other not. And I don't think you can really compare too much with the, I think the argument is, okay, well, we're looking at this after the Tour Championship was had, which has elevated points for the BMW, also the FedEx. So throwing that out the door a little bit, you start to kind of see, okay, Kitayama, by the results, had a better season than Hideki Matsuyama. So it goes back to our original argument of, is this the best system? Can you play in all signature events and play a little bit worse than some guys and stay inside what a lot of people think to be the golden event to play in, which is the Tour Championship, which now gives you into the majors, an extra season on the PGA Tour. Why don't we just start there, Charlie?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are, and there's another document we have here that I will not share, but I'll pull from our rundown. But just percentages, and this is actually just through the regular season, because the chart we're looking at through the Tour Championship. But if you're looking at percentage of points that are won through signature events, if you start with the group that won the least, Kurt Kitayama, top of that list, 0% of his points from signature events. And heading, let's see, through either entering the BMW or on the other side of the BMW was 35th. Chris Goddard up second, only 1% of his points from signature events.
Isn't that crazy?
It's wild, right?
So he basically had the best season of somebody that didn't play in any signature events.
And it's interesting, too, because we're starting to form some trends here. The points you're making about Kurt Kitayama playing good late, winning, couldn't get into signature events. The same thing with Chris Goddard up. We see him kind of burst onto the scene late, wins a Scottish Open. So part of that is, okay, it's just the way he played in the schedule. But I almost think in some ways that does further a point of, okay, we're looking at the top of the list and we're talking about guys that played good and won, and they're going to be safe. They have an argument to make about making it to the Tour Championship, how much marginal money they lose out on. But what about a guy that's further down the list and who's trying to kind of play his way into a signature event or trying to keep his tour card, and he gets, you know, playing good late, but he doesn't have any method of entry into a signature event via a next 10 or a swing five type of scenario, right? Like,
right.
It's almost like you got to get the starts early, which I think, as we'll discuss later, I actually think a lot of the changes they've made with tour cards going to 100
are really good changes,
because they're going to guarantee guys starts. And, you know, whereas past seasons, you get the hands you your card. You're one of, in the past, 30 Korn Ferry Tour graduates. And you're like, great. I love to go play Sony. Like, well, you can't. You know, and maybe that's not an exact example. I'm sure most of the Korn Ferry Tour graduates were able to get in. But just basically what I'm trying to say is, when you get your starts, you better cash in on those, really play really good golf at the beginning of the season. Otherwise, you are way behind the eight ball. And everyone else that gets off to a hot start and plays good golf in those first few months can play their way into these recurring categories, so that's, they right, can retain their tour card or make their way into signature events. And so Kitayama, Goddard, Brian Campbell, Ryan Gerard, Ryan Fox were the top five in terms of all players who made it to the BMW but had less than 10% of their points won through signature events. On the flip side of that scale, Russell Henley won the most amount of his points through signature events, 79%. Shane Lowry was second at 78%. And then in a tie for third, Tommy Fleetwood, Keegan Bradley, and Patrick Cantlay all won 77% of their points through signature events. So it's just I think it's an interesting exercise to say, is this thing working? I think that in a lot of ways it has worked, and there has been some smoothing through very intelligent people, hashtag math guys like Maverick McNealy, but there is still some degree of, we've just made a choice here. The PGA Tour has made a choice here. They're okay to some degree with keeping guys playing in the ecosystem. In fact, in some ways, I think they want it because they want those stars to stay there, because that's how they're going to try to sell their lead, right?
Okay, let's look at the positive side of full field events. Not saying that if you're just in full field events, that's a place where careers go to die. Well, we've seen careers completely elevate from players that have played really well in full field events. And if you look at this season, for example, Ben Griffin is the best case example, a guy who had 12 top 10s this year, made 1,400 points in full field events. That is some stupid golf. And that's not even including what he has done this fall, which is winning another one. So almost up to 2,000 points of what you would typically earn for another win. Cameron Young, another good example, a player that that had 735 points. You already mentioned Chris Goddard, 900 points was earned. Remember, that's a pretty big number for just being in full field events. Some other players too that had good seasons that maybe didn't get to play as many signature events. Andrew Novak was a good case study of a player who played his way into the system. Sam Stevens and Jacob Bridgman are also two others. Michael Kim being also another player too. So there, I do like the system in that you can play your way into it, but it really is not very rewarding to players that have good summers.
Right. And that's probably the best way to distill it, is just that you got to play good early. And that's an interesting one too, because
you don't have to, because Chris Goddard still made the tour championship.
But we're talking about a guy who won.
Yes.
Right. Like if you are not going to play good early in the year, you better go out and win later in the year. Right. Like, that's kind of it, you know, because all those guys you're talking about
into the top events that we're looking at,
like Jacob Bridgman, Sam Stevens, guys that were near the top of leaderboards in January, February, March, you know, Florida Swing, kind of end of the California Swing. Like those guys play good early and they kept themselves in that position through their play the rest of the year. But like, they really got off to a hot start and stayed there.
Okay. So how about this? I got a question, trivia question for you.
Okay.
Okay. I want you to name two players that had the least amount of points in signature events that were playing in them.
Two players had the least amount of points.
Hold on. Start over. This is like the game show again.
I was going to say, I'm like, we just talked about the dad back, I just got flashbang. Oh, Smiley's got a turtleneck on. He's asking Ryder Cup questions.
I totally like, it was not even the right category either. Like I had to start over because I really was asking about full field events. What player who maybe made the tour championship that earned hardly 0 points in full field events.
Okay, so this player made the tour championship and he played well in signature events, but not full field events.
I mean, you can throw in majors players too, but I'm not even going to do the trivia because it's kind of confusing. Colin Morikawa,
yeah,
made less than 100 points in full field events, 75 points, and he earned 1,053 in signature events and only 299 points in majors and players.
So 74% of his points were from signature events. Imagine how much more that is if he wins Bay Hill instead of comes a second.
I know. Ludvig Åberg's another example. Same player.
72%.
Made less than 150 points. He did not play well in the full field events this year. The ones that he did play in, if I recall, had some missed cuts along the way too. So it's not a perfect system by any means, because you really, especially when you see the guys that finish in the top 30 year in, year out, they go and miss cuts in these full field events. You're just thinking to yourself, like, man, well, how would they do an entire year with full fields? You know, would they be able to make as many cuts as they do now? Because going from 70 to 50, when half the signature events are cuts and half aren't, it's pretty easy to kind of freewheel your golf game, not having to worry quite as much about losing your card.
Well, and I'd even love to really dive deep with the stats department on. And this is just a theory. This may not hold true, but just looking at the composition of a 4-day no cut signature event where some of these guys earn lots of points, where if they just played okay Thursday, Friday, do they make a cut in a full field event, or are they kind of lost in the mix? And then you just go out and light.
You go light it up
on moving day.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden there are less people you have to jump, right? There are only, you know, 70, 80 people in that field. So you know, maybe you're in a place where you could have missed the cut and got 0 points. All of a sudden you catapult up and you're getting way more points. And that's the kind of the bread and butter you're living off of to stay in this category. Now, maybe you crunch the stats and that's not an issue at all, but these are just the types of things that the system is set up to query about, right? Just to like, sure. is this, you know, how is this thing working? And again, and it may come back down to, this is the way we want the system set up, because we want to keep these guys in and around these events because they are our superstars. They're the way we market the game. They're, you know, what we sell against from a television contract perspective. And that's a decision, right? But yeah. It is one that is, you know, many would rightly say is kind of against the spirit of what the tour has been in the past.
Okay, so the one last game I'll play with comparing two players, Tony Finau, a guy that was in all the signature events, and Gary Woodwin, a player that was playing well throughout the year, just missed out on the playoffs, finished 72nd. Tony Finau, being in the signature events, made it to the FedEx St. Jude, finishing 66th. So he did make the playoffs. And just looking at their results, Tony Finau, just one top 10 on the year. Best finish was a fifth at the Genesis. No other top 10s. Gary Woodwin, one top 10, and it was at second place at the Houston Open. That was a fun event watching him. But the other cool one is Woodwin had eight top 25s, Tony Finau, just five top 25s. So it's kind of marginal right here when you're looking at this, and it makes sense when you're just adding up all the points. But just another example of Woodwin having, I think, probably a better year when you just look at down his results versus Tony Finau, and one making the playoffs and one not. And it's so fractional that we're breaking this down based off of like three more top 25s than another guy. But when we're looking at what you're earning at a signature event versus what you're earning at a full field for 20th versus 20th, it's different. And that's what it comes down to.
Well, and it's absolutely that. It is hair splitting. We understand we are doing that, but it really is. It's just illustrating, you know, in further depth, the way the system is set up, right? Where it's okay.
20s aren't the same.
The 20s aren't the same. And the decision that's been made there is Tony Finau made his way into signature events, the previous season, or I have to go back and look to see where his 2024 season ended to definitively say what that was. But basically, like, we're going to reward him well into 2025 and in a way help him boost his chances for 2026 based on that prior year.
23rd.
Like, yeah. So there you go. So he makes it to East Lake and you say, okay, you have status through the following year. And we're going to effectively, you can go out and have a worse year than a guy who's in a similar position, and you're still going to get into the playoffs the following year. Like, that's, you know, and so again, that is there are a lot of things that are set up like that in the game of golf, multi-year exemptions for guys that, you know, are playing well one year, not so good the next year. So it's not like it doesn't have a precedent, but it just is an illustration of the way the tour has constructed the system so they can keep guys.
Can you play your way off of a PGA Tour top 100 card, being in all the signature events? That's kind of the conversation that's worth having. And the only player that looks to be outside the top 100 right now is Adam Scott. It's not the best example of a player because he's not going to go chase top 100 like another guy will, because of maybe the amount of starts that he has. As far as just being able to play weeks on weeks on weeks in a row, I think he played, let's see how many events that he played this season. He only played 18 events. He finished the season at 90th. Right now in the FedEx Fall, he's 103rd, but he still has eligibility through next year. He's not going to go chase playing events in the fall to finish in the top 100. I don't think Adam's at the point of his career where he wants to do that. So the answer would be that this year, it doesn't appear that anybody did.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah,
I mean, there's an argument to be made there.
Well, and I think in a similar but very different position, you know, a Max Homa kind of fluttering around that top 100 line and having a very different type of year and sort of a downward trajectory off of where he had been, and going out and deciding to play some events in the fall because he wants to kind of get tuned
Max
up.
Max is the best example. Yeah, Max is one.
Yeah, and Max has, you know, three additional years of exemptions on the PGA Tour past this one. So it's one of those things where, he's gone back to an old swing coach and Mark Blackburn. Like, clearly there was some value for him in trying to kind of play and grind and earn status that way. But it's you know, he was already exempt anyway. So it's one of those discussions where it doesn't matter as, you know, I don't want to say it doesn't matter at all, but it doesn't matter as much in the scheme of, like, can a guy go one year from having his card? And it also depends on where he finished, right, in the tour championship and the top 50 the previous season, because that gives you exemption for the following year and the year beyond as well. So
I was the other player too. I was looking, because I remember the prior year, Ricky heading into the 24 season was in all the signature events, and then he finished 108th. Mm-hmm. So that's another player that had to play all full field stuff last year. Now he is in a position. he's a position that I think a lot of people made arguments. Well, because of his name, he was able to get into some signature events. But I think when you go look at his points, which I just got to find it here on the list, it might take me a second to find. I think it was like around 31st is where he was. Yeah, here he is. So he made 319 points at signature events, and then only 240, it says, at full field events. So he definitely, it's for him, he definitely has an advantage that he's had an incredible career, one of the most marketable players in the world, that they have a system set up to where he can take advantage of his weeks, which I'm trying to see how many he played signature events this past year. He played Pebble, he played Genesis. Let me double check this 25. That's right. So he's got two there, and let's see, Memorial. So that's three, and then Travelers at four. So he played in half.
Right. And I think that there is, I'm going to sound like I'm kind of,
but like, that's not like you could imagine that other players would be upset about not having a marketable name. Is it the most fair system? I don't know if there should be sponsors invites for signature events.
I think shooting for fair is going to be a fool's errand. Like, I think that you just have to understand realities of the way all these things work in today's day and age. Like, you can lament the fact that they work the way they do in today's day and age, but, you know, to pay for television contracts, all these sorts of things, like, you have to have players in these fields to generate revenue. Like, you just have to.
It's more the title sponsors of what is being asked of them to pay for these signature events. Was it $25 million? So you're starting to see companies split it up between different title sponsors, because it's a bubble. It feels like it's a bubble that could pop at some point, because sponsors invites are important in that if a player doesn't get into signature events, it's okay, we can get these four guys in that had poor years a year before just to cover our butts here on not giving the best product to what we're charging. You know, that's just basic business here.
Yeah. I mean, I think I don't want to sound like nihilistic. Like, I feel like, there's a portion of this is just just embracing what it is, you know, just like, I think it's worth examining. I think it's worth talking about on a year to year basis. I think it's worth saying, ooh, this is really out of whack and we got to change this a little bit. But I also think that there's just a part of this where you just have to say, this is the direction the league's going. And by the way, like, with a guy like Brian Rolapp coming in, who's all about product and how can we kind of grow this thing, I wouldn't expect this to change. In fact, I think it should go further in this direction. But he has a task in front of him. I mean, you know, I think if you really want to zoom out and you look at like television ratings for these things, you know, the Masters compared to like a normal NFL Sunday is still, you know, it I don't want to say pales in comparison, but it's like, you have to, golf still remains a niche market. Now, it's a market we love. It's a sport we love. And we all, you know, and the Masters is our Super Bowl, right? Mm-hmm. But you also have to understand that there are decisions that have to be made from a business perspective, like sponsor exemptions, like these sort of signature events, because these are things that fund the ability for us to watch it and consume it. Like, and if you don't want to wrap your head around that, I don't really know what to tell you. Like, that's just, there are lots of things like that in American society and in global society.
And I think the PGA Tour made the right decision to go to a top 100 model. Although you can make the argument too, if you're somebody who kind of lives in that 100 to 125 year after year after year on the PGA Tour, like Joel Damon is a player who's kind of been in between that 170 to 125 his entire career. And this year he's falling in that 115 range. So on one of his, he's very consistent of where he finishes year after year, but it's just maybe a slight tick down of a year that he normally has. And he's all of a sudden looking at being outside that top 100 and being a conditional PGA Tour member, unless he has a good Butterfield, Bermuda Classic, or an RSM. And how about that sponsor plug on Bermuda? That was pretty good there. That was kind of rolled off the tongue.
Yeah, it really did. But every time I hear the name of that tournament, I want to eat a Butterfinger.
Yeah, that's right.
I don't know if that's Do you want me to kind of start moving into that section of it? Just reading about these changes from 26 and discussing
the priority
those?
Ranking. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So just to recap some of what we already discussed, as you know, that the exempt status for 26 changes from top 125 to top 100. As Smiley notes, that the conditional status, it's really broken up from 101 to 150, but there are three separate groups there: 101 to 110, 111 to 125, and 126 to 150. Okay. Then full field sizes are changing as well. Full fields are going from 156 to 144 players. And then there are also other circumstances where limited daylight fields, some fields are going to go to 120 or 132. The two courses or the two events that will stay at 156 are the Amex because they have three courses, and the Genesis Scottish Open because it's the middle of summer in Scotland. There's plenty of daylight over there. And Players Championship, that field size is going to 120 beginning in 2026.
Which that's a good change. That's a good change. The players needs to have less guys playing. It just needs to feel a little bit more elevated than what it is, because there's so many times at the Players Championship, I would look at the field and be like, how did this guy get in? It would happen every year. It needs to, especially with what the PGA Tour puts as their crown jewel. This is the PGA Tour major championship. And I know it should be for all of its players, but when you have signature event model that only has 70, there's a huge gap there. So 120 to me, which I think is closer to where the model should be for signature events anyways. I think 100 is probably where you should land. Like if you are a PGA Tour, make that top 100, I think you should be able to get into what it should be, the elevated events. I think 70 is too little. 100 is kind of about that sweet spot. And I think that's a good move for the players.
So, and then just to continue on that field size thing, the Monday Q info, bad, tough scene for him, I guess, is the open qualifying is changing in a lot of different ways. They've been eliminated. Open qualifying spots have been eliminated for full field events with fields of 120 and reduced to two for fields of 132, fields of 144 maintain four open qualifying spots. And then for some category changes as well for the DP World Tour, Corn Ferry Tour and Q School. So the DP World Tour stays at 10. Corn Ferry Tour goes from 30 to 20, and PGA Tour Q School goes to 5 instead of top 5 and ties. So this leads us to our 2026 priority rankings. And so this is, I'm reading these to you in order. The top priority category is tournament winners, then top 70 on the FedEx Cup points list through the FedEx Cup playoffs, then number 71 through 100. This is where it starts getting interesting here, and you stop me wherever you want to jump in. The next group on that list is the DP World Tour top 10, which is positioned just above the Korn Ferry Tour top 20, and then the Q School top 5. Then we go to the PGA Tour University, both the number one finisher and accelerated for the prior season and current season. And then the top 70 non-member FedEx Cup points greater than or equal to 70 on the 2025 FedEx Cup fall points list. Then top 30 on the 2024 FedEx Cup points list in year two. And then career money, top 25 and top 50. And then life member. And those groups are you have a full tour card this year. Everything we get past that is conditional status once we get a 101, you know, 101 and beyond. So anything you want to kind of pick up there, Smiley, and discuss?
All right, I'll start with what I think is wrong about the DP World Tour and the Korn Ferry Tour and the amount of spots that are given to both of those leagues. DP tends too many. The talent level, it just hasn't proven enough to me to grant 10. Five seems like a better number, where I feel like there should be five extra spots given to the Korn Ferry Tour with top 25 on that tour. So you're not taking away spots from the overall amount. It's more so just adding some to the Korn Ferry, taking away some from the DP. And I don't think that's wrong right now. My opinion might change on that in the future. But until with LIV Golf around, you know, they seem to be plucking away some talent over the DP World Tour year after year, especially with how they fill out their lineups. It seems like on some of these teams that aren't not the star power of these names that are filling out the top of the leaderboards at LIV. But guys that are played on the DP that are on these teams as their 3-4 guy. Some of you would know their names. Some of you would. But I just feel that 10 is a lot. And then how it's currently ordered, I think this is another talking point that goes back to our conversation this past week about the PGA Tour having an agreement with the DP and a strategic agreement. So, which is what you need right now, because the DP, of course, could have easily got into business with the PIF or LIV and had some type of co-sanctioned deal. But right now the DP still, gosh, it feels like it's almost a feeder tour to the PGA Tour, because you're giving your top talent away year after year to the PGA Tour. So the PGA Tour in here is rewarding that. Their priority ranking being above the Korn Ferry Tour, I could not disagree with more, but it seems like going to less cards available, that they're able to guarantee most anybody with a PGA Tour card this year will get into a full field event. So it kind of takes away a little bit of that frustration for me, coming off of the Korn Ferry Tour, thinking that's more difficult to do than the DP, which is, by the way, it's not the top 10 on the DP World Tour. It's the top 10 without a PGA Tour card. So it's not exactly, you could have a guy that's outside the top 25 on their list, which
it usually goes to about 15 ish. Like 15 and 17 the past couple of years, we're crunching numbers and looking at guys. But I think that's a very important point. Let's start with the positive, which is, I think the move to 100, making everything past 100 conditional, is a really good one, because it makes having a tour card worth something. You can get the starts you need. Everything we just discussed in terms of, you know, if I have this opportunity, can I actually have a realistic chance of keeping my tour card if I'm a graduate off the Korn Ferry Tour, DP World Tour, wherever? I think this does that in a lot of different ways. So I think that's really good. The DP World Tour, Korn Ferry Tour positioning in terms of priority is a fascinating one. And as you've mentioned, connects back to what we just discussed, which is to say that even if you believe that there's more talent coming off the Korn Ferry Tour, which I think you can make a compelling argument for a number of reasons, one of which, yes, is what you just said, where if you're it's not just the top 10, because you have Rory on that list and just Tommy Fleetwood.
You have a decades worth of data that you can point to of players that have come off that tour to the PGA Tour that are still playing on the PGA Tour.
Yes. And so if you're getting a watered down version every year, and it keeps getting watered down, right? Because you're taking those guys from the DP World Tour, and it's the next guys up, they're either going through, either they didn't earn their status on the PGA Tour the year before and they're going back, or it's kind of, coming through a feeder program on the DP World Tour, whatever it is. You can make the argument, and it sounds like you believe it, that the better players are coming from the Korn Ferry Tour. But In the sort of the light of this strategic alliance between the PGA Tour and the DP World Tour, if you put the Korn Ferry Tour above the DP World Tour on that priority list, they're absolutely a feeder tour at that point. I mean, they already are in the sense they're literally delivering players to the PGA Tour. But that's the whole optic thing of, oh, this isn't a feeder tour, this is an alliance, a partnership. If you're taking,
they're just prioritizing them over the Korn Ferry, which I disagree with.
Well, and the Korn Ferry Tour is quite literally the PGA Tour feeder tour. So if you're putting that feeder tour above the DP World Tour, they can think nothing else than, we're just a feeder tour. And I think this is where you kind of start getting into, and not to necessarily rehash the conversation, but just to kind of provide context for those who didn't hear the conversation we had before, is that the DP World Tour has a real crossroads moment here, where they have to decide whether the 100 million, whatever the rumors are, like that huge sum of money that the PGA Tour is delivering them to underpin those purses and fund events, is that worth being a de facto feeder tour and shunning the money that they could get from the PIF, the LIV Tour, to have a partnership there, especially in light of the fact that they might lose two of their best Ryder Cup players via that sort of lawsuit, where if they lose their DP World Tour cards, they can't play on that team in a dare manner. So there are a lot of things happening where if I'm at the DP World Tour and I'm a decision maker, I'm like, wait a second, could we just ask the PIF for $100 million and partner with them and not have to give up our 10 best players and maybe get a bunch of international guys that want to come back here and play here instead, in addition to live events? I think it's a complicated thing, but I think that's why the PGA Tour, I understand the difficult position mm-hmm. they're in as well, but they have to give that list of guys coming from the DP World Tour real credence, because the further they move them down, the more it's like, wait a second, is this really worth it for us at this point? If you're a DP World Tour executive,
I wish I had a little bit more data for you, because would this be the third year now that we're taking DP World Tour players?
To my recollection, yes. I have to go check on that. But yeah,
I know this past year, the 10 guys that came. Now, remember, Tom McKibben left to head to the Live yep. Golf Tour. I believe he played San Diego and then bounced right after. But I don't think it's been exactly as successful with the 19 players or 18 players, depending on if the year prior. Maybe Adrian Meronk left was another guy. Even with all of that, and you haven't seen these guys come over here and play well, I do think when you've gone from the DP having a really good season, then coming over the PGA Tour, and then when they get here, they're like, wait, I'm not in that event, or am I in this event? And just coming over to the States, learning new golf courses, I don't think it's exactly easy to do. And I think you have to be a very, very good player to come over here and keep your card, because I think very few have been able to do it at this point. I think there's some promise. Like, I'm really excited about Marco Penge coming over from the DP World yes. Tour. I think he's a player that fits PGA Tour golf. He hits it hard. He's a player that I think could translate. I was really impressed with Jesper Svensson this year. I thought he was an awesome player, but he's going to lose his PGA Tour card. So
that list, just so you have it, of this is last year's graduates.
Yeah.
Rasmus Højgaard, Tristan Lawrence, Paul Waring, Jesper Svensson, Niklas Norgaard, Mateo Manicero.
Rasmus was a good. So
Thorbjørn Olsen, that's right. Antoine Rosner, Rikuya Hoshino, and Tom McKibben.
Okay, so Rasmus is the only guy keeping his card.
Yeah, and I think, you know, to your point, like, we're excited about Marco Penge. It looks like Alex Noren is going to retain his PGA Tour card through that point yes. system rather than the FedEx Cup system.
He has a medical too.
So, I mean, there are guys on that list that, you know, we're excited to see play, but, you know, there aren't a ton like past those two guys. It's not like I'm exactly fired up about the list of graduates as they currently stand. I mean, Christopher Reitzen, Adrian Sadir, John Perry, Lori, well, there is one on this list. I cannot wait to see Hao Tong Li back on the PGA Tour. Yes. I love Hao Tong Li. Yes. So I'm excited about him. But you know what I mean? It's a mixed result, and it's interesting. Just evaluating the success of that program relative to like what it's meant to do. I think honestly, I'd say this way too for the PGA Tour. It's been a huge success in terms of not having a massive competitor emerge. So you could give me your worst 10 players and I'd still be doing it at this point if it means they're not partnering with LIV.
Yes, and that's going to be the tough part, I think, is when these players have really good seasons coming off the DP World Tour. I think it's every single year you're going to have a Tom McKibben and a Marco Penge that are going to have to make a decision on, should I go to LIV or should I go to the PGA Tour? Should I accept status or not? Because as soon as you accept status with the PGA Tour, that's when all your hurdles are going to start. You know, it's then you have to either deal with a long-term suspensions if you don't resign, or if you do resign, then you just got to start the process all over again, which is totally fine. There's nothing wrong with starting it over, but it's definitely a decision to be made. Tom McKibben is it appears that he made the right decision for his bank account. Can you make an argument that maybe some of the changes that have kind of been beneficial to him, like a Hong Kong Open rewarding a master start and getting a pathway to the majors, helped his case without knowing that was going to happen heading into his decision to join LIV? Well, sure. Yeah. And has it helped him playing with John Rahm week after week? Yeah, probably has helped him. Is it difficult to make the transition from Europe to the States? Yeah, it's really hard. It's very hard. Look at Robert McIntyre. He was a player that smoked it on the DP World Tour forever. He was playing on the WGCs before when they were still going on. But he really struggled with the transition. I mean, he's just a when you think of Scotland golf, like I think of Robert McIntyre. I don't think of Ford or Robert McIntyre. Like, that's got to be a tough transition for him and his family. So it, especially with the age of some of these guys, it can't be easy, but it's an opportunity that you can't pass up as far as the opportunity to make a name for yourself in the States. Not to say that you can't do it on the DP World Tour, because you can, but more exposure to the American markets, the official world golf rankings, and more money. They're playing for a lot more money over here than the DP.
Just to kind of continue down this list of conditional members, and just to get your viewpoint really on the split here between 101, 110, and 111, 125. So the next category listing in the priorities, the priority list here is 101 through 110, you know, of 2025 fall points list through the RSM Classic. Then you have 300 career cuts. Then you have three-time winners on the Korn Ferry Tour / DP World Tour. Then you have major medical extension, and then you get to 111 through 125. So I guess the question I have for you, first, we've heard a lot of guys say this. Michael Kemp said this on our show, is that I still think guys and that category, both those categories, are going to get a lot of starts. Mm-hmm. I mean, how many do you think we'll see in terms of entrants from 300 career cuts, three-time winners, major medical, that are going to separate those two groups in a meaningful way?
Well, I think 101 to 110, just looking at this, seems to be a much better position to 111 to 125, especially when you throw in the medical extensions and how many players that could potentially be for getting in an event and not getting into an event. But I think you could probably play 15 events as a 111 to 125, which honestly, when you used to be a conditional member back when I was playing on tour, so if you finish 126 to 150, 15 was a fair number, I think, what you expected to kind of get into that next year being a conditional member. So I feel like that's probably going to be about the same at that spot. Sure. But 126 to 150, like, sayonara. Yeah.
Well, so you have then after 111 to 125, you have minor medical extension. Then you have 126 to 150. Then you have non-exempt medical extension. And then you have beyond 150 past champions and veteran members.
And then you have me.
Past champion. I was going to say, hey, look at you. You're slotted in right there above special temporary member and veteran member.
Ooh.
So, I mean, you're at least you're not DFL on the priority list. Like, you have an outside chance. What did you do? How many starts do you think you could get if you actually applied for events next year, Smiley?
Zero.
You don't think you could get in one event on past champion status?
No.
Really?
I mean, unless it was a bit, I don't know.
Well, I mean, I'm not saying you actually would do it. I'm just saying a guess on how many entrants there are to these events, but maybe not. Maybe not.
I don't think I'd get any. It just would feel wrong. I'd rather somebody who's want to take one.
Let me reframe the question, because I'm not asking you seriously whether or not you're going to do this. I'm more so asking about that place in the priority list. And I guess really what I'm getting at here is, if you think about every special temporary member in the past couple of years, the way that they cashed that in was sponsor invites. Right. Sponsor exemptions. Like, that's how they got in those tournaments. They didn't get in by just applying for the tournament. They had to get a sponsor exemption to be able to continue playing as a special temp member, unless they top 10 the week before or whatever it was to get into the next tournament.
Yeah.
Correct.
Right.
Yeah.
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 That's right.
So there you go. We've exhausted everything there is to know. I feel like I've just unrolled a giant ball of yarn. Anything I missed here today, Smiley?
The only thing that we did not discuss, which I think we can briefly just kind of read out who's on this list, but Tiger Woods is the head of the Future Competitions Committee, which I think is interesting to note, as there's many micro committees on the PGA Tour that players are heading. Tiger Woods happens to head the competition committee. So this entire conversation that we've had about who gets into events, the order, the priority order, how many points are being awarded for signature events versus full field events. Well, you have the GOAT that's heading that committee. And I think you have the rest of the names that are on that as well.
I do. The rest of the names on that committee are Patrick Cantlay, Adam Scott, Camilo Villegas, Maverick McNealy, Keith Mitchell, and then from the non-playing side, Joe Gorder, who is the chairman of the PGA Tour Policy and PGA Tour Enterprises boards, John Henry, who is, of course, the principal of Fenway Sports Group and manager, the de facto head of the Strategic Sports Group, and Theo Epstein, senior advisor for the Fenway Sports Group. How about that?
Fenway golf trip with him. He's awesome.
So that is your future competition committee, of course, headed by Tiger Woods.
Okay. Well, I think as we look ahead to 2027, I think that's this committee is probably more so focusing on that year and how the schedule is going to be formatted, potentially how they can tidy up some of the things that we find to be a little unfair and maybe the membership finds a little bit unfair too. I think this was a step in the right direction to go to 100 because this is going to be another great case study year to see if this is all fair. Are players getting enough events compared to other players? Do they feel comfortable about knowing where they're going to play? That's always one of the worst feelings as a player, not knowing what you're going to be getting into. So I think that's a step in the right direction, but this priority board, or I should say this competition committee priority board, Maverick McNealy being on it, that's great to hear. You know, Keith Mitchell, also a player who I think has been on the wrong side of this 2 years in a row, who's maybe he didn't play as well this year, but last year, I should say Keith actually played very well on Thursdays this year. Friday through Sunday played pretty well, but not like Thursday. I think he led like five Thursday rounds this year, if you remember that right.
Keith and Tommy Fleetwood, like, you would not want to have those two pitted against each other in a first round leaderboard. Exactly. Those guys sweat it out up on Thursdays.
but Keith is a player 2 years in a row who's maybe he's gotten into one signature event, but has played. I think many people would peg Keith as a guy who's talent wise is easily a top 50 signature event and a name on a leaderboard that people recognize too. So having him on the board on this committee is good from that standpoint, because he can make arguments like Maverick McNealy did of, okay, hey, I can compare, but just like we did this mm-hmm. exercise here with you guys today with Kitayama and Hideki, or with Gary Woodland and Tony Finau, you can compare and just be like, I mean, you could say play better for how long can you say that mm-hmm. to where this is the most fair system, and then getting into sponsors exemptions, and how it affects title sponsors and how much money they're paying and knowing that they have an opportunity to improve the field. There's so many things that are slightly unfair to the rest of the membership. And I think 2027 will be interesting to see how they improve some areas.
It's a really representative group, and you've got, you know, young and old, international. Smiley cares so much about this topic that he just ejected his highlighter out of his hand in the midst of making a point.
I do. This is people's livelihood, and yeah. You want the most fair system. And yeah. I think it would have bothered me a bunch if I wasn't a name. Once I was just an introverted guy, just not going to ever get a sponsor. Yeah. It would bother the crap out of me if I felt like I played better than a guy. It just feels like two separate tours at times.
Well, I mean, I think it's a good point you're making, and it's one that, again, will be informed by new leadership and by the priorities of that new leadership. And by a lot of other things too that we discussed, you know, like what happens with the DP World Tour, you know, what happens with those appeals with the LIV guys, what happens with LIV, you know, who's to say they're going to stop at the 72 hole change? Like, yes. I think this thing is continuously a moving target that we have to kind of break down as we go. And I definitely would not expect these to be the last set of changes we see. In fact, I think too, you know, playoff changes we've talked about, like they revert to a very simplistic system this year. That's not going to stay the way it is long term. I don't think so
either.
The only constant is change.
And we nitpicked a little bit throughout this, finding some negatives. There's plenty of positives. There's a lot of things that I think are great about the PGA Tour from a competition standpoint. The fact that you have an opportunity to play yourself into signature events is great. But we also pointed out, like, you need to do it early, you know, to like take to reap the full benefit. So there's avenues that have been created for players to move up to where you don't ever get stymied in a year. I guess the last thing that I would suggest is that I wish that we could see these Korn Ferry Tour players in the fall. If we're going to continue to make the fall a thing to where you have now you're continuing, you're like adding an event in Austin, you're adding an event in Asheville, and it always felt like
Rollap was gonna be sick.
Yeah, it didn't always feel like they were just gonna wipe the fall with the PGA Tour and just be like, all right, we're not playing golf in the fall, now we're like adding events now. So let's get the Korn Ferry Tour guys playing for some money. Let's get them comfortable with the PGA Tour. And but then the argument's like, well, what about the guys who didn't get, you know, the full opportunities throughout the year? And here they are now. They're not getting into these events because of Korn Ferry, or guys coming off the Korn Ferry. And then maybe you can bring in the DP guys too at the same time, although their race to their whole thing is still ongoing.
Well, I think that's a whole other show in itself. It's one we talked about before. It's like, I'd be a proponent of shutting out the top 70 or whatever it is. I mean, you'd have to reconfigure the next 10, how that applies to signature events the next year, but shut out the top 30 or shut out the top 50 guys who are already into signature events, and then make the only people who can enter the fall events 51 through, because what you're doing then is you're creating a sub tour that has a positive connotation. You know, it's like, hey, we know that you're not going to see elite players here in the fall, but what you are going to see is a fierce competition for 49 spots or 50 spots, plus reshuffling within those 50 spots for 10 spots to get in the signature events this next year. Like, that becomes compelling in its own right. Now, I know pitching that to a sponsor kind of stinks. You're like, wait a second, I have no chance of seeing the top 50 players in the FedEx Cup the previous season. Okay, that's not great. But at the same time, it's like, what, you know, all these things are a balance. I think I'm glad you brought up what you did there as well, which is that, even as we nitpick these things, you know, if all these decisions were easy and there was a quick and easy and simple answer, you wouldn't need a future competition committee. Be like, great, we're just going to do this and everyone's going to be fine. I guarantee you all these things that we're nitpicking at are the same conversations that these players and stakeholders are having in the boardroom. Like, hey, I don't really love that this is the way that this is, but if our stated goal is to reward this subset of players, we have to do it this way. So all these things are trade-offs they have to make. It's just like, what's the trade-off that's being made? And we're examining that and deciding whether it is worth it.
Exactly. And to point out too, I know we say that the fall has been like a throwaway, but you've also, I mean, you had Scotty Scheffler win this fall. You had Xander Schauffele win this fall. you've had Ben Griffin win this fall. You had like a great story in Michael Brennan, who's like a breakout potential star, who's been on the show. If you haven't listened to it, make sure you go listen. Stephen Fisk won in the fall. And then, I mean, it's actually been a very, very productive, great fall, but, kind of been lucky, you know.
yeah you can't guarantee it all the time. Well, if you made it all this way, congratulations. This is dense stuff.
So this is for the grinders. This is for the gritty
sickos.
Grinders.
True sickos. That's all I got, Smiley. Any final thoughts from your end?
I've been putting this episode off for quite some time. I've been excited about it because I am passionate about this stuff. So hopefully it all came across the right way. And a lot of people probably walk away a little bit more educated about the PGA Tour than they were before. And just about maybe how players feel about how the tour is, and just a little locker room talk today. So it was productive.
Cool. Yeah. You can continue that in the comments on YouTube. We want to hear your thoughts on these things and debate alongside you. So that's what we got. I guess we'll see you in about a week here on the Smiley Show, and we will see you on Golf Channel, Wednesdays 9 a.m. in 2026.
That's right.
Talk to you soon.
See you.
You know, I listen to this podcast. It's really cool. And
all of our fans and subscribers, but make sure you like and subscribe.
It's cool to see what you guys are doing. I know golf fans appreciate it, but we do too. So please keep it up.
For all the good people of YouTube, like and subscribe.
You guys have some good takes, so I'm happy to come on and shoot the